Welcome, dear friends. So lovely to be together again. My name's Barbara. I'll be your bellminder tonight. So let's just take a moment and enjoy all the lovely spring flowers in our garden of practice. So lovely to be together and to see all your faces. So this year's theme of practice for us is welcome everything, which is clearly an aspirational practice. Open our hearts to it all. So tonight we'll have a silent meditation and then we'll go from there. So you might want to check in with your body and your posture and let your body decide what's the perfect posture for you right now so that you are relaxed and alert and can stay comfortably still for the next period of time. You might want to turn your attention to your shoulders. You might even want to roll them a little bit or shrug them. Just make sure that they know that for the next period of time together, they don't have to hold up the world. You can just relax. And moving your attention down your spine to your sacrum and your bum and your pelvic bowl. Just let gravity hold you. Just release any feelings of needing to hold yourself upright. Just let gravity do that work. Settle you into your seat. And moving your awareness down to the soles of your feet. Yes. Hello, soles of my feet. What do you have to say to me tonight? And then moving your attention to your heart chakra, to the center of your chest, where your heart and your lungs. And just notice how open or constricted your heart energy might feel right now. However it feels is perfect. And you can gently encourage your heart energy to open by being aware of your scapula, of your wing bones in the back of your heart. Even opening your heart and your chest a little bit. And then settling into stillness. The Sangha is invited to go back to her breathing. The Sangha breathes as one body, and there is no more separation. We practice like this. Please take care of your body, stretching or hydrating, whatever feels right. So our theme tonight is everything matters. I'd like to start with some medicine from our teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. The first one was on the invitation to the talk, so you may be familiar with it. A quote from him that said, "This, my dear, is the greatest challenge to being alive, to witness injustice in the world and not allow it to consume our light." And next he says, "When we come into contact with the other person, our thoughts and actions should express our mind of compassion, even if that person says and does things that are not easy to accept. We practice in this way until we see clearly that our love is not contingent upon the other person being lovable." Some of you may know that Thay's teacher was most well known for loving the unlovable. So as Thay's students, he is our grandfather, and this energy and this capacity is in our spiritual DNA. So we can practice to embody it. This is medicine for our time. For most of us, it's an aspirational view of how to be. It's important that we don't use it to blame ourselves for falling short, for this constriction of our hearts at this difficult time. Instead, we use it to lift our spirits, to nurture a vision of the best in us humans, to hold our bodhisattva vow as the light for our path, to aspire to be the love, regardless of circumstances, to cease reacting to the turmoil in the world, and instead learn to respond as lovers, as clear, compassionate students of the Awakened One. Everything matters. Everything affects everything. Teacher and author Sharon McMahon holds up Harriet Tubman as an example of American heroism. She explains that Tubman's life included a long list of obstacles and difficulties and virtually no access to power and no resources except for one. Harriet Tubman understood that everything she did mattered, that whatever she could do, given her circumstances and her ability, made a difference. And now she's a source of inspiration for us all. The story of Indra's net offers a powerful image expressing the truth that we're all jewels in an endless connecting web, each jewel reflecting every other jewel. Each of us is reflecting each of us. Everyone affects everyone, and everything affects everything. Offering a smile, a moment of peaceful silence, a kind word, the way you open a door for someone may change the dynamics of a situation, setting healing or injury in motion. Our practice wakes us up so we can choose the path of healing and true happiness as we move through our day. Nothing is more important than bringing calm and friendliness to our world right now. And I'm getting a message that I'm confirmed that I'm speaking in Estonian. So, no, I'm not. I don't think so. I don't even know what that would sound like. I'd like to spend some time tonight with the Lotus Sutra. Some of us have read Thay's commentary on the sutra in a beautiful book called Opening the Heart of the Cosmos. I just love that title. I think now the name of the book has changed to Peaceful Action, Open Heart. So back in 2010, which was 15 years ago, folks, some of us who are here tonight participated in a 6-month class where we studied and practiced with this text. So let's take a glimpse into the wonders of the sutra. So let's travel together to India. Let's climb the Gridhikuta mountain together. When we arrive, we hear the Buddha teaching. It's near the end of his life, and the full name of this teaching is the Lotus Blossom of the Wonderful Dharma. It's known as the highest of all sutras because it accepts and integrates all schools of thought, and its key message is inclusiveness. Thay tells us, quote, "For many centuries, Buddhist practitioners have revered it as the most beautiful flower in the garden of the Mahayana Buddhist teachings. It was compiled, written down, and circulated about 700 years later. To understand this teaching, you have to put on your ultimate dimension glasses, as the teaching comes through metaphor and magnificent imagery." Traditionally, the sutra is divided into two sections. The first deals with the life of the historical Buddha seen through our ordinary perception. The second section deals with the ultimate dimension, which reveals the Buddha as a living reality, free of limiting notions, dwelling happily beyond dualism. Because the Buddha is free of the limitations of time and space, we are also invited to sit at the foot of the Buddha right now as this message of liberation is delivered and to receive the fruit of understanding. The central message of this sutra is that everyone, with no exceptions, has the capacity to wake up to become a Buddha. Everyone is welcome at this gathering to sit here with us on the mountain. You can invite all your friends and loved ones to come sit with us. Who would you like to share in this wisdom? Take a minute to bring them to mind, those you consider your friends, as well as those you might consider your obstacles or even your enemies. There's room for all of us. As the teachings were understood and developed, they blossomed into the Bodhisattva path of service, grounded in love and inclusiveness. We aspire to keep returning as a helper until every being is liberated. There are so many deep and rich teachings in the sutra. Tonight, we'll just touch on one or two. I encourage you to delve deeper into them if you're so inclined. So, as I said, the setting of this teaching is Gridhikuta Mountain, which is also called Vulture Peak. Unlike most of the sutras you and I might be familiar with, it's marked by its imaginative theatricality. Thay explains that at the time, India was going through a period of cultural revival, and teachings were often presented as drama, using parables and colorful characters. Some of you might be familiar with the famous Hindu texts, the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, which are also presented in this way. This made the teachings more accessible to more people. Think of the wildly popular TV shows Dynasty and Ted Lasso as examples in our time. So, on the Gridhikuta mountain, the Buddha sat with a huge assembly of followers, both his current disciples and also tens of thousands of great bodhisattvas and thousands of gods, including Indra. This tells us right away that we are now in the ultimate dimension beyond the boundaries of time and space. He also performed miracles, causing heavenly flowers to rain down and sending out a ray of light that illuminated various cosmic realms. All this display is to get our attention, like when we hear the wake-up sound of our bell, announcing that something special is about to occur. I'd like to share a personal teaching I received from Thay in January of 2009, when I received the lamp transmission to become a Dharma teacher in our lineage. When a student gets an invitation to receive the lamp, they are asked to write and submit an insight poem expressing their aspiration. At my ceremony, Thay was seated on the right side of the altar, and when my name was called, I walked mindfully to the center with two attendants behind me and performed a series of prostrations to the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, and the ancestors. Then I went in front of Thay, where he read aloud the poem I had submitted. After that, Thay offered me a poem from the ancestors and gave me a lamp that he lit from his larger lamp, signifying passing on the light of the Dharma. This is my lamp. It was lit, but she needs more oil. And Thay had a great big lamp that he lit it from. So the first line of the poem I received from the ancestors is, "On the path returning to the Gridikuta mountain, I see lotus flowers blooming." Thay explained to me that these lotus flowers were the many bodhisattvas present. So Thay was inviting me and all of us to join this great assembly and to not limit myself to seeing the world only through the eyes of the historical. Through wondrous sights and sounds, daily miracles can lead us beyond being stuck in our small point of view. Connecting deeply into one thing will inevitably lead us into the understanding of Indra's net, that every moment of life is reflected in every jewel connecting the net that holds all things. As teacher Carolyn Mace says, every single choice we make is an act of creation. And it affects everything else in a web of interbeing and interdependence. During the lamp transmission ceremony, Thay first read the poem from the ancestors in Vietnamese, as it's written on my certificate, and then translated it into English. He suggested that after the ceremony, I go to a senior Vietnamese monastic to help translate it more thoroughly. The third line of the poem I received is, "In the bitter cold winter day, you have a cozy fire to keep you warm." Thay said that the fire is my mindfulness. Later, when I went to two different monastics to translate my poem from Vietnamese, they both stopped at this line and remarked that this doesn't just refer to a cold winter day, but that it means an extraordinarily bitter day, an extraordinarily difficult time. Thay was telling me that my inner fire of practice will protect me in very difficult, challenging times. I share this with you now so we can all lean on the supreme confidence of our teacher, that our practice will show us the way in these deeply uncertain times. Thay is telling us that we have everything we need, just like the Buddha did in this next story from the Lotus Sutra. In chapter 15, called Welling Up Out of the Earth, the story goes that the many great bodhisattvas who had arrived from throughout the cosmos bowed to Shakyamuni Buddha and offered to stay on Earth to help all beings wake up. The Buddha thanked them, but he said, "No, thank you. There are enough bodhisattvas already here on Earth to take care of this world." As he spoke, the ground split, and an incalculable number of great bodhisattvas rose up out of the earth. They were described as having bodies of pure gold, and each brought with them many followers. Thay tells the story of a meadow in the upper hamlet of Plum Village, where every spring a huge field of daffodils blooms. When the Sangha first arrived on this land, they didn't know about the bulbs under the earth. And then in spring, when the blossoms came up, Thay said they could see the ultimate dimension right at their feet. He says, when you know how to look deeply into the historical dimension, you touch the ultimate dimension. French surrealist Paul Eluard says, there is another world, but it is in this one. Quoting him in her book, Mozart's Starling, Lyanda Lynn Haupt says, one world is marked by bland forgetfulness, where we do not permit ourselves an openness to the simple graced beauty that is always with us. The other is marked by attentiveness, aliveness, love. This is the state of wonder, which is commonly treated as a passive phenomenon, a kind of visitation or feeling that overcomes us in the face of something wondrous. But the ground of the word, she says, the old English wundrian, is very active, meaning to be affected by one's own astonishment. We decide moment to moment if we will allow ourselves to be affected by the presence of this brighter world in our everyday lives. As bodhisattvas in training, we cannot afford to get stuck in the historical dimension, especially at this time. We have to build and maintain our view of what's possible. Thay explains that one key to understanding the stories of the Lotus Sutra is that when the gaze of the characters is towards the earth, they are referring to the historical dimension. And when they are gazing upwards, the story is set in the ultimate. When walking outdoors these days, I find that I need to keep my gaze on the ground, as worms, sometimes 8 inches long, like to be out for walks at the same time. So learning to not miss the sky and the trees while still being aware of the worms is a practice of balance and equanimity I do on my daily walks. We need to include both ways of seeing, so that understanding and the energy for transformation can be generated. Sometimes we have to move from the world of words to other ways of perceiving, like music, art, movement, and body-centered practices, as well as to speak the language of ceremony and symbols. The stories in the Lotus Sutra can teach us skillful means, how to make choices and nourish ourselves in our world, and can remind us that we have all we need right here and now. When we train ourselves to see through the eyes of the ultimate, it not only brings us relief and confidence, it helps the transformation of our world. Dharma teacher Larry Ward talks about the need to change our social imagination, which still comes from the colonial mind. We need to imagine a society anchored in the bodhisattva path, where every being is honored as an essential jewel in our wondrous net of life. Let's take a couple of moments to return to our breathing and to see how simple it is to connect with our ultimate self right in the middle of life. I breathe in the historical dimension. I breathe out, letting my exhale go beyond time and space. As many of us know, our teacher Thay was a revolutionary in his way of thinking and acting. You may not know that Thay was the first monk in Vietnam to ride a bicycle. Traditionally, it was considered inappropriate for a monk in robes to get on a bicycle, but Thay simply saw it as a more efficient means of transportation than walking, so he began riding. Some of the elders were quite shocked. Thay was also a revolutionary in his interpretation of the Dharma, and added his own understanding of the Lotus Sutra. As we know, it's traditionally divided into a section speaking from the historical dimension and one from the ultimate dimension. But Tai realized that there's a third dimension to this story, the dimension of action. I remember when Robert and I were at a three-week retreat in Plum Village, and Tai sprung this third dimension on us. Not wanting us to just listen to the teachings as philosophy, Tai always anchored them in the concrete, showing us how to embody them. So how do we embody the understanding of these two truths, the historical and the ultimate? We follow the Bodhisattva path, which we've already been studying for 2 years. Now we can loop the three dimensions together so we can see more deeply and walk our talk so we can be the agents of change so desperately needed right now. Before we shift from the ultimate back to the historical, let's enjoy a poem from Larry Ward. As you listen, perhaps you can feel it nourishing your connection with the ultimate dimension. Larry's Dharma name is True Great Sound, and I can hear his majestic voice in this invitation. The poem is called Enter Your Life. Enter your life like a great epic poem. Ride the colors of change with the wind, unafraid and unattached, in light of the coming and going of all things. Savor the stars and the dark blue sky. Trust the sun in your heart to guide you home. Here, between earth and sky, listen. Hear your footsteps in the leaves of time. Fix your gaze on the horizon of not yet, but stay in this moment and ask in this great symphony, what is my instrument? What is my music? What is my song? And then surrender to this crucible's alchemy as it creates the mandala of your holy life. Cross the lake of life's mystery like a fearless swan, embodying grace, embodying peace, embodying compassion as you head toward the other shore. Tai tells us, quote, as our mindfulness becomes more stable, the ultimate dimension of reality will appear more and more clearly to us, right here and now in the historical realm, the world of appearances. Recently, I've been realizing how skillfully Tai wove together teachings on the historical and the ultimate dimensions. He spent a lot of time showing us ways to build more loving, harmonious relationships with each other. Even though he became a monk at 16 and lived in the monastery his whole life, he seemed to know so much about the challenges in being a parent and a spouse and could give practical advice to lay people. At the same time, he would repeatedly bring in the ultimate, reminding us that there is no birth and no death, that our freedom comes from the view of non-discrimination. So let's touch back into the historical dimension and remember how to nourish our precious bodies. The body of Shakyamuni Buddha is gone. Tai's physical body is gone. And Tai told us that the next Buddha to come, Maitreya, will manifest not in a single body, but in a community. We need to let go of our limited ideas of ourselves and step up to be part of the next Buddha's body. In the first decade of this century, Tai would offer a three-week teaching retreat every other year at Plum Village, and he named these retreats various body parts of the Buddha, feet of the Buddha, hands of the Buddha, etc. In his poetic way, Tai was asking us to step up and recognize that if we want the Buddha in our world, we need to volunteer. Our question is, are we willing to offer ourselves to be a manifestation of the Buddha? Stepping onto the Bodhisattva path is our response. This is our time. The Buddha taught us how to live in these bodies, beginning multiple teachings with body-centered awareness. The Sutra on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness starts by learning to be aware of the body in the body. This means that we don't just conceptualize or imagine our bodies, but we inhabit them. We learn to invite our awareness into and through our whole bodies, offering gentle attention and loving acceptance and care. The Buddha also taught that there are four new kinds of nutrients we're always taking in: edible foods, sense impressions, volition, and consciousness. We need to learn to identify what we need and don't need, and what effects these various nutrients are having on us at any particular time. This is a practical, deep teaching that we could spend a lot of time on, but for now we'll just do a brief review. Our volition is our motivation. It is our deepest desire, which fuels our intention. And we know that our intention, either conscious or unconscious, is our rudder and determines where we end up. So being aware of our volition is key to making conscious choices and to liberation. At the start of sitting meditation, it's always good to remind ourselves of our motivation, our intention in the moment, and in our life. Just naming something we aspire to nourish in ourselves can ground and enhance our practice. Probably like many of you, I've noticed that I've become much more sensitive to the sense impressions I take in and their effects on me, not only day by day, but hour by hour. I now make a conscious choice before I expose myself to the news and to conversations that might be relevant, but that I don't have the capacity for at the time. I'm aware of my need for spiritual and social nourishment, and am actively choosing what to take in and what to dismiss. My nature is generally happy, and I usually wake up glad to be alive and looking forward to the day. But one morning recently, I woke up after a good sleep and realized that I wasn't feeling happy. There was nothing specific bothering me, so I understood that it was time to actively nourish my happiness. At our group meditation that day, I brought some just picked pink camellias, and we did the practice called 10 Breaths for Happiness, where you focus on something beautiful for at least 10 breaths, letting the beauty and goodness and joy touch those elements within you. Apparently, we all needed that practice as it was a meaningful event. To remind myself of the goodness in myself and in the world, I spend a lot of time listening to Dharma teachings, and frequently turn to the many offerings on the Plum Village website and as well as other sources. Like with any kind of skill, we need to have multiple tools at hand when our happiness needs attention. Let's take a few breaths as you bring to mind several ways that you can easily nourish your happiness. My body wants water. So once again, in this teaching on the four nutrients, the Buddha instructs us to start with our physical bodies, as the first of the four nutrients is the edible foods that impact our health and how we feel. We're probably all aware of the importance of eating nourishing, healthful foods and avoiding ones that leave us feeling empty. Most of my life, I've put a lot of importance on learning what my body needs and choosing my food carefully. I've also spent a lot of mental energy trying to figure out the best diet, sometimes with the underlying agenda of finding the one that will let me avoid illness and the troubles that can come with aging. I can now look at how much of my volition came from an authentic desire to live my best life, and how much was from wanting to avoid the inevitable decline of my body. How can we aspire to be our best selves while not being driven by aversion to the vicissitudes of life? Another trap I've fallen into while doing my best to figure out the best eating plan for myself is to compare and judge all the other ways to eat, deeming my current choice the right one. I remember many years ago sitting with a book in one hand that declared the only right eating plan was to eat a low-fat, high-carb diet, while the book in my other hand declared the exact opposite. That's when I realized I wasn't going to find my answer from books and other people's theories, so I began to listen to my body and respond to what it was telling me. Recently, I watched an interview with Warren Buffett. For those of you who may not know who he is, Buffett is the founder and CEO of the investment fund Berkshire Hathaway, and his net worth is almost $150 billion. He's pledged to give 99% of his fortune to philanthropic causes. He's now 94 years old, though to me he looks at least 25 years younger. Buffett was born in Nebraska to a middle-class family and continues to lead a simple lifestyle. He says that he eats pretty much the same way he ate when he was 6 years old: hot dogs, hamburgers, and cherry cokes. I love this story as an antidote to all the judgment I've held through the years about what must be good for everyone else since it's good for me. I return to our precious teaching of don't know mind, letting go of deciding what others' nourishment should be, and coming back to listening to my own self and the results of my actions and my choices. So to turn our awareness to the four nutrients we're always taking in, we need to learn to slow our momentum, to stop and listen. When we learn to listen to ourselves, to the sensations in our bodies, the subtle signals from our emotions, we are cultivating the skill to make better choices about what to take in and what to avoid. We learn when to speak and when to stay silent, when to step up and when to let be. Our mindfulness teaches us how to respond to life in any given moment. This becomes our protection and our guide. This helps us live in a way that brings healing and transformation, and avoids increasing difficulties and confusion in the world. Dr. Isaac Ilias is a medical doctor and also a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. He explains that our bodies are designed to cleanse and purify. Our hearts receive pollution from the air we breathe in and cleanse it before pumping our blood out to the rest of our body. The heart practices non-discrimination, taking in whatever comes and purifying it. In the same way, when our minds are calm and open, whatever comes will not disturb us. Our compassion and joy will receive and hold it so that transformation can naturally occur. We rest in the flow of our true nature, and both physical and mental purification are the gift of our natural state. It's just possible that the daily onslaught of difficult news is teaching me how to stay open while not getting caught, strengthening my muscle of equanimity, the ability to keep my heart open and my eyes clear. The understanding that the current story being flashed before my eyes has no more substance than the cloud floating above me. While the suffering is real, the story is not. Feet firmly on the earth, heart embracing the big sky, I can be a refuge in a time of chaos. Along with the great challenges of this time, there are also great opportunities. Let's not miss the chance to grow our hearts, to strengthen our commitment to love. Recently, I read this teaching of Thais in the Plum Village newsletter. When I read it, I felt like it was pure water for my thirsty heart. I need daily reminders of how to stay grounded so I can be of some use these days. Thai reminds us of our sovereignty, the place we take a stand. He says, "The territory of our person is very large. If we do not know how to bring peace and order and well-being into our territory, we cannot help a friend. We cannot help a brother or sister to do the same. That is why to restore peace, to restore order, and bring well-being into our territory is the first act of peace. Without this practice, peace will not be possible. Outside is also a territory. If the territory inside is occupied, we have no more sovereignty over it, and it becomes a mess. When it becomes a mess, it contributes to the situation of war outside. The territory outside is just a projection of the territory inside. Because the land in which we live is a collective creation of our consciousness, of our inner self. Suppose we are 100 people, let's say 30 people, who are peaceful. We are capable of smiling and loving each other. Then the piece of land in which we live will become peaceful. The kingdom of God inside determines the kingdom of God outside. Paradise is a collective manifestation, and hell is also a collective manifestation. It depends on our territory inside." In a book called The Power of Mind, A Tibetan Monk's Guide to Finding Freedom in Every Challenge, Khyentral Lhota Rinpoche says, "We need to bring whatever understanding we have of ultimate nature into our present experience." So, how do we do this? One of the languages of the ultimate is the art of ceremony, ritual, and the creative arts. As we saw with the Lotus Sutra, the teaching of the ultimate comes via metaphor, symbols, ceremony, and imagination. Since we aren't limited by time and space, we can realize our true nature, that we are truly connected to all. We can call in our ancestors for guidance, and we can help heal their wounds. We can invite in grief and loss, and let it fill the colors of our days without getting stuck in it. We can open to the unknown and let mystery guide us. We can let go of needing answers and solutions and instead embrace the questions and the miracles that are already here. We can imagine a world grounded in the Bodhisattva path and begin to manifest it right here and now. We can update our social imagination to include the principle of inclusiveness and the reality that love is our ground. Recently, I heard an astrologer say that starting now through 2028, we are in a cauldron of creativity. So let's respond to this moment, tapping into what brings us joy and moves us beyond our normal ways of seeing and doing. Our normal seeing and doing operates in the horizontal dimension. But when we get stuck here, believing and acting as if this is the whole of life, despair may set in. We need to bring our eyes up, to turn our attention more to the vertical dimension, to see the possibilities written in the stars and the flight of the butterfly. This is not an escape, a way of bypassing the ills going on around us. Rather, it's a way to see clearly and to keep our hearts open as we tend to the daily challenges and assaults. In his book, A Flame, Pico Iyer says, "The sacred is not a sanctuary, it's a force field. In many ways, a forest fire. You can try controlled burns or backburning. You can walk towards the heat, but its power comes from the fact that it can't begin to be controlled or anticipated." As we let our imaginations take us into what is possible, we begin to change the social imagination. We acknowledge the outmoded, stuck ways of being and open the door for change. Then, through stories, ceremonies, and symbols, we chart a new course. We allow the marginalized parts of ourselves, our wounds and grief, our feelings of abandonment and betrayal, to have a place on our altar. We let the shadows merge with the light, and our experience of life becomes more potent and powerful. We are able to change this historical by calling on the energy of the ultimate. This is ceremony. Psychotherapist Francis Weller says, "Grief is essential to finding and maintaining a feeling of emotional intimacy with life, with one another, and with our own soul." He tells us that when we're stuck in grief, it's usually not possible to get through it alone. You need to acknowledge your need for connection and that you can't find all the answers on your own. You have to ask for help. And this is where our strength lies. In doing this, we're remembering Indra's net, that we're all connected and we all reflect one another. We are not alone and are not meant to hold any of this on our own. Weller calls his work our apprenticeship with sorrow. So I learned that the Hubble telescope made possible the finding and studying of exoplanets, which are the planets outside our solar system. So we have 8 planets in our solar system, the Milky Way, and it's now understood that most stars are orbited by their own sets of planets. So, if there are billions of stars in our galaxy, there are billions of planets orbiting these billions of stars. Does this remind anyone of Indra's net? A few weeks ago, I was part of an online class on dreams that Peggy Rowe offered. And one of the exercises was to draw a picture with several elements in it, such as a path, a flower, a mountain, a butterfly, and others. Now, in my usual reactionary way, I didn't want to do it, but I finally got out a piece of paper and some markers. And at first my voice told me, "This will be awful, you know you can't draw." Eventually I got into it, drawing without much thought and no investment in the outcome. And at the end, we talked about our pictures, and as I looked at mine, I grew to really like it, probably because it wasn't drawn from my ego self, but was a story from my unconscious. It's still hanging in a favored place on the refrigerator door. There's a national movement that you might have heard about or might not called Arts for Everybody, with major activities occurring in 18 cities. They have like 3,000 people come to an event, and everyone is invited to participate. They come together and dance, sing, paint, and draw, and write. Over 3,000 studies have shown that participating in the arts promotes physical health, including improved brain wiring and cellular mechanisms. Doctors now do what is called social prescribing, encouraging clients not only to exercise and eat better, but to exercise their creativity muscles, preferably in community, as a way to improve their health. Artist and spiritual practitioner Suika McCall says, "Creativity is an antidote to authoritarianism." Let's think about that for a moment. The creative spark comes from somewhere within you, and also not from you, but through you, from somewhere in the cosmos. It's not just an expression of your small self, but of the miraculous world we inhabit, the ultimate dimension. This is how we can change the social imagination, by using our creativity to express the magnificence of the ultimate. Our world needs every one of us to be a vehicle for the creative spark that is our unique life. As theologian Howard Thurman said, don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and go do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. So if your deepest desire is to be part of the evolution of our species, let your focus become simple and pure. Use every moment of your precious energy to manifest the beauty, joy, and wonder that is our true interbeing, our web of love. Let this intention reorganize your life. I know for some of you, the creativity spigot is already freely flowing, but we can all find an activity or a way of being that isn't our usual way of moving through life, and experiment. So when you walk from your bedroom to your bathroom, do you ever walk backwards? Can you remember to notice which hand you stir your beverage with and try choosing the other one? Any interruptions in our usual way of doing something can bring us a bit more alive to the moment. There are times when the whole world celebrates a ceremony, like the funeral of Pope Francis a few days ago, which filled our world with a spiritual energy of peace and gratitude. And we're all participating in rituals every day. I have rituals that bookend each day, that help ground me in clarity and intention and bring me comfort. Our lineage has many ceremonies that mark important times and events passed down by our ancestors. You can read the scripts of several in our Plum Village Chanting and Recitation book. They each start with meditation, followed by incense offering and chanting, which is a way to declare to the cosmos that we're starting a conversation, similar to how the Lotus Sutra begins. We can do the same thing, lighting a candle or a stick of incense in full mindfulness and singing or chanting along if we're up to it. Do you know there's a gatha, a verse we can say when we light a candle? And several for lighting incense. Most important, we can make up our own. We can let our own consciousness speak to us by listening to what is most needed right now when we are fully present. Do we need to get up and move, to use our voice, to connect with nature in some way by selecting something to honor our altar? An underlying truth in every ritual is that everything we do matters. Each choice we make has meaning and serves to empower the ritual. The smallest element of beauty can represent the entire cosmos. One small stone can bring all of Mother Earth to your table. In this way, we can invite our ancestors to join us and start to heal the wounds of the past. When we embody the truth that we're not separate and not limited by time and space, the boundaries that usually hold us dissolve. The truth is, we have millions of years of wisdom living inside us, and our work is to make the space to let it shine, to welcome the edges of our conscious universe, to see what lies within and beyond. My greatest experiences all have the element of knowing this is not me, that forces bigger than me are running the show, that I am in harmony enough to be used as an expression of the ultimate, of the all. And in my experience, you have to ask for this. You have to open your heart and set your intention to be used. Whenever we step into the space of ritual, we step into community, and we know that we're not alone. We cannot be there by ourselves because our ancestors and our spiritual friends will inevitably show up. It's a place we all want to be. So make room in your heart and your mind for your imagination to take center stage. The funeral of Pope Francis began with the line, "Let us prepare ourselves to celebrate the sacred mysteries." That's a good intention for any ceremony. Here's what we need to make our ceremony successful. An open, curious mind, not needing to interpret or know. A compassionate, loving heart, allowing without judgment or preference. An ability to make room for everything. A welcoming of the mystery. A comfort in knowing we will never understand it all, and we don't need to. At the in-person Day of Mindfulness in Ashland on June 14th, we're creating a ceremony that celebrates being together. We're finding that just one ceremony won't fit all our needs, so we're creating a hybrid one, where we will both honor our Sangha loved ones who have died, and also celebrate the Buddha's birth and the summer solstice. We're calling our ceremony No Coming, No Going. During our Day of Mindfulness, we'll spend every moment of our time together celebrating the precious gift of our bodies and using our imagination to transcend time and space. We'll sit in silence, we'll sing, and walk outdoors. We'll listen to our bodies while in deep relaxation. We'll eat and share and wake up together. We'll deepen our awareness that we're being held with comfort and care in our community of interbeing. Come if you can. We'd love to have Tiger Mountain folks join in. So to review, here are a few things we can do over the next 3 months as we walk the Bodhisattva path. Ground ourselves each day in our somatic wisdom. This simply means treating our bodies as wise elders who speak an ancient language of truth. Learn to listen and respond to our wise self before we take action. Allow our hearts and minds to let go of the normal boundaries of time and space by engaging in the language of the arts. Whatever encourages us to experience our world from a different view will help us in this process. Changing our smallest movements, asking questions. How does that worm see his journey across the pavement? That can start us on our way. Be both bold and humble in performing ceremony, inviting our ancestors and our multi-species siblings to join us. Ask sincere questions that come from our deepest desire. Expect no answers that we can comprehend at this time, but invite them to inform our way of being. Let our imaginations fly free. Tell big stories about how our world can be. What will it look like when harmony, freedom, and love are generating our story? In the 60s, we called it, "Let your freak flag fly." Let your imagination soar. Catch the fireflies of the possible and let them light your way. And step into the dimension of action by revisiting the teaching of the Bodhisattvas. Choose one that has the empowerment you most need right now. Developing compassion, seeing the Buddha in everyone, gaining clarity, cutting through illusion, protecting the earth. The medicine that will help you most now can be learned through a good Bodhisattva friend. Recently, I was able to spend some time at the ocean, being reminded that I am the waves and I am also the water. One of the oldest and best-known metaphors to explain the two truths of the historical and ultimate dimensions is that of the waves and the water. To end our time together, let's listen to Tai explain it as we close our eyes and return to the refuge of our breath. Let us visualize the waves appearing on the ocean. Some waves are big, some are small, and each wave seems to have its own life. A wave may have ideas like, I am a wave. I am only a wave among many waves. I am smaller than the other wave. I am less beautiful. I don't last as long as that other wave. Ideas like that. A wave can be caught in jealousy, in fear, in discrimination. But if the wave is able to bend down and touch the water within herself, she will realize that while she is a wave, she is at the same time water. Water is the foundation of the wave. While waves can be high and low, more and less beautiful, the water is free from all these notions. That is why, if we're able to touch the foundation of our being, we can release our fear and our suffering. Touching the foundation of our being means touching nirvana. Our foundation is not subject to birth and death, being and non-being. A wave can live the life of a wave, but a wave can do much better than that. While living the life of a wave can live the life of water. The more our solidity and our freedom grows, the deeper we touch the ground of our own being. That is the door for emancipation, for the greatest relief. And just a reminder from our dear brother John Lennon, who told us, everything will be all right in the end. If it's not all right, it's not the end. So, do we have any announcements? Dorothy?
I just wanted to remind Peaceful Refuge Sangha and Tiger Mountain, if you want to join us, that next Tuesday will be the first time we use our new book, the Eight Realizations of Great Beings, for the text of our practice, and the pages we'll be reading together are page 28 through 30. So if you have a chance, read the introduction, but most of all, just come, because it's such precious Dharma rain. You'll be nourished no matter how you get there. Thank you.
Is there anything we want to say about the Day of Mindfulness, registration, or anything about that?
I just sent out the registration forms today, so you should, if you're not getting these emails I send out from the Peaceful Refuge Sangha website, please notify me. There's something wrong if you're not getting them, because you're all on the list, so watch your inboxes.
You send it to Tiger Mountain folks too, Dorothy?
No, I didn't send it to Tiger
okay.
Mountain folks.
So is the registration form on the web, Peaceful Refuge website?
It is. It's on the website. And also, okay. I sent one today to Tim, so he could send it to everybody else.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anybody who wants to come, we'd love to have you.
Yes.
Anything else to be said?
Yes, Barbara. Well, first, thank you. That was wonderful. And I would like to invite Peaceful Refuge to join Tiger Mountain in a simple little practice that we've picked up, where each week we give some homework. And it's just a simple act of engaged Buddhist practice that we take on with the intention of performing during that week as a Sangha. So we do it together. And oh, I'm speaking Estonian too. So our homework for this week is going, say, in the past we've done things like do an act of kindness for Mother Earth, do an act of kindness for a neighbor or for yourself. So this week our homework is to reach out and connect to an old friend or family member who you've lost touch with. And so please take that as an aspiration. And that's our homework for this week. We'd love to share it with you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, if we are complete, let's offer the merit of our practice. May the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Barbara,
for being here.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you so much.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
And so wonderful.
So many of you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here, Tiger Mountain.
Yep. Love to see you. Thank you, Barbara and all, for being here.
Inspiring.